Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, if you're like me, you sometimes worry and wonder about whether or not you're doing enough to help protect and enhance our environment. It seems like it's under attack in many different directions. Sometimes we get so discouraged that because the challenges seem to be so overwhelming, and sometimes as a result, we just don't do some of the smaller things or important things that we could be doing. That's why a new book called Small Stories, Big Changes, Agents of Change on the Front Lines of Sustainability, edited by Lyle Estelle. Am I saying that right?
Lyle Estelle, yeah.
Yeah, who's one of the local heroes of the environmental movement. He's recruited just a big handful of other local heroes who show us in their stories, in the essays that are collected in this, that there are things that we can do, and that some of the small things that we start out doing can become big things. Two of the authors, Tim Tobin and Blair Pollock, whom most of us know, important people, and our neighbors here in Orange and Chatham County, are here as to talk about the book. But Lyle Estelle, it's your book. Tell us about it. Where in the world did this book come from?
thanks so much, DG. I was inspired over in Paris, actually. I was over in Paris with the family, and I was reading a bunch of American literature at the time, you know, the Hemingways, and thinking what a great group of people they had, and the arts were flourishing, and the literature was flourishing. I was reading a bunch of 1920s and 30s American literature in Paris, and I thought that there's a similarity in my life. I'm in the sustainability movement. I work down at Piedmont Biofuels, and it dawned on me that the people that I work with and the people that I socialize with and the people that I spend my days in this endeavor with are a pretty interesting group. And so I collected 14 different authors, 7 women and 7 men, for this book, which is an anthology of stories. I also think that in my space, which is climate change and peak oil and the part of the world that I inhabit is sort of filled with unfathomably complex problems, things that are, you know, daunting to the individual. And so I find that as I travel through this space, I look for inspiration wherever I can get it. And people like Blair and Tim and the other authors in the book are the people that have provided me with inspiration over the years. So that's why I included them, and I tapped them and said, look, let's put together a book of all of these small stories which lead to big changes. And that's where the genesis of the book came
from. Well, tell us about your story.
Well, I started deep frying turkeys back in 2002, and I started making my own fuel. That's the last time that I went to the gas station to fill up, was January 2002. And in the process, I've constructed Piedmont Biofuels, and we're a little community-scale biodiesel organization. We collect fats, oils, and greases and use them to power our community.
When we talk about this as a big hope for the future that we'll be able to rely on sources of fuel other than what we pull out of the ground. You haven't solved the problem, but you're doing it. I mean, you're not dreaming about doing it. You're doing it.
I mean, that's true. We're certainly not an alternative, a solution for fossil fuels. We are one tool in the sustainability toolbox, and we have a little membership of about 400 people in the triangle, and so there are 400. Families that are running around on our fuel that is derived from waste products that we collect.
And how does it work? Waste products.
Used cooking oil from restaurants and from industry, and we take them to our plant in Pittsburgh, and we spin them into biodiesel. Biodiesel is a drop-in replacement for petroleum diesel.
And is it a complicated process to do this? Is this something I could do in my backyard?
It is something you can do at home. It's not rocket science. We are a chemical plant, and the work is sort of heavy, smelly, greasy, and dangerous.
And is it profitable?
It is. We made our first profit in 2011, had a great year in 2012, and we're on track for 2013 as well. So we're into our third year of solid profitability.
Oh, that's great. Now, Tim Tobin is somebody is famous in this part of the world, busy, How did you? What about his story inspired you, and why did
so my,
and how did you get him to take time to write it
yeah,
up?
Yeah, so well, I had to hound him, like many of the people in the book. My relationship to Tim and his wife Megan comes through their Pickards Mountain Eco Institute, which I actually hadn't visited. I was a latecomer to that place, but our interns used to run up to Pickards Mountain all the time, and they would come back to Pittsburgh and tell us how great it was, how they were ahead of us on meat processing, and how they were ahead of us on growing their own food, and how they were ahead of us on this and that. So I always had sort of a chip on my shoulder about Pickards Mountain. Finally went up and had a chance to meet Megan and Tim, see what they were doing up there, and I was completely inspired. Then Tim went into Greenbridge here in Chapel Hill, and I was a big supporter and big fan of that as well. So I, when he ran afoul of the anarchists, I took his side, and you know, I would write blog entries and newspaper columns and so on in favor of Greenbridge. So I've been deeply inspired by the work that Megan and Tim do up there, and that's one of the reasons that they're in the book.
Well, in a minute, we're going to get Tim to tell us the story, the stories that he tells in the magnificent essay. Well, another friend of ours that you've recruited is Blair Pollock. Every time I take on, well, tomorrow, well, I'm on Thursdays, take my little box of recyclables out, and I think about the work that everybody in Orange County is doing, but how did you bring him into the fold?
Well, so I've known Blair for many years, and I've been an admirer of the Orange County recycling programs, and actually, I've been an admirer of his candor and his honesty.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that from time to time, people in government, like Blair, have a tendency to maybe not speak truth to power, not be honest about what it is we're doing. And I find that I've found Blair to be refreshing on that front, in that he absolutely gets it when it comes to environmentalism and the role that things like recycling and landfilling and methane gas from capped landfills and all of this plays in our environment and society.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break and then come back and see if you can get some of your colleagues to either Tim Tobin or Blair Pollock to tell us about their essays.
Great.
We're visiting in the context of the release of a new book that Lyle Estill has put together, Small Stories, Big Changes, Agents of Change on the Front Lines of Sustainability. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about a new book put together by Lyle Estill called Small Stories, Big Changes, Agents of Change on the Front Lines of Sustainability. And Lyle is here to talk about his book. And Lyle, you brought two of your co-authors, and you've told us about them. Can you persuade one or both of them to talk about what they did?
Yeah, Tim, jump in. Tim Tobin from Pickards Mountain Eco Institute is here. He's got one of the chapters in the book, and of course, he's also known as the legendary developer of Greenbridge here in town.
DG, thanks for having us. Lyle, I appreciate you inviting me to participate in the book. It was not a story at the time that I wanted to rehash and to think about again. There was a lot of difficulty, as many folks know. This was a project that we hoped would be one of the great model green buildings in the Southeast, and we had the support of the town council to build it, and the neighborhood was supportive. And we started the project in April of 2008, and all of the five families that were the investors of the project anteed up and put in big chunks of money and signed guarantees on loans from the bank and from other mezzanine investors. And we got into the project, and of course, October 2008 was the big crash. And so our
timing couldn't have been worse.
It really couldn't have been. And so we kind of nursed the project along and got it built. We were proud to finish it. But we, at the very end, we were about $1,600,000 short. and the bank refused to loan us that last amount. This was a $62 million project, so it was a really big project for us and for the town. And we were tapped out. The investors.
I'm interested in the economics of this. This having practiced law and done bankruptcy work and all of this.
Right.
But what I'm really interested in is right now looking at it as a completed project and what was accomplished in terms of providing a model, and then what are some of the things that, looking back at it from the standpoint of building a sustainable building, that you learned that you would apply or that successors can apply? What have we learned from this project?
This was a project that was designed by William McDonough, who was the great green architect who's done projects all over the world. It is a wonderful project, and it's proving out to do what it was intended to do. It produces, it requires about half of the energy per square foot of a typical building, and it uses energy from the sun, and it uses natural daylighting, and it has a water source heat pump that pumps water throughout the building so that when the east side of the building during the day gets hot from the eastern sun, that heat is transferred over to the west side of the building. And then in the evening when the sun is facing the west and it's hot on the west, the energy is transferred to the east side of the building. So it's a fascinating project and actually does exactly what it was intended to do, but it was extremely expensive to build. This was, roughly 100 units that cost $62 million to build. So the cost in the project was $620,000 per unit. Now, that is a big number, and it turned out to be too big a number. And, I think the good news about the foreclosure, which is interesting, is that it sort of extracted about $20 to $25 million out of the project. Unfortunately, that came out of my hide.
Came out of your pocket, yeah.
Several others.
Well, thank you.
But it actually put the cost in line with the market, and so it ended up doing exactly what it needed to.
Yeah.
Do.
I guess that's sort of the focus of my inquiry, and yeah. that is that what it takes in order to have a building like Greenbridge that is economically sustainable, that you have to have so many million dollars of subsidy from private investors, or could it have succeeded had the times been right?
DG, we were idealists going into this thing, and we were inspired by an idealist who was William McDonough. And we spent too much money on that building. We put all the bells and whistles into that building. I mean, I could list 30 features of that building that makes it one of the leading edge, technological buildings in the country today in terms of green design. It was too expensive to build at the time. It was a big project for Chapel Hill. It was too big a project for us. And we thought that the market could sustain it. We thought that if we build it, they will come. And, that may have been true. It was ambitious adventure in a great market. And then, of course, the market crashed, and we came down with it.
So we can't know for sure whether it would have worked had the market been. You've learned is that you've got to be a little bit more careful about putting everything into it.
And to your question, DG, these things can be done now in a cost-effective way, in a sustainable way. You don't need all the bells and whistles. You really, I think what I've learned from this project is that small can work very, very well. And the things that you do at home and the places that the fact that Megan and I now have changed our lives so that we grow most of our own food, like Lyle and Tammy. And, Lyle and Tammy probably grow 90 to 90% of their food.
You admitted, for anybody who joined us earlier, Lyle bragged that he ate breakfast off of the cucumber that grew
the
on his back.
You
can't brag like that yet, but you're coming close.
I can't
close.
Brag like that yet. Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm aspiring to be a Lila Stell and a Tammy Schwerin. But we do grow a lot of our food. We produce our energy with a solar array on the farm. We buy our biofuel from Lyle, and we also grow a lot of our medicine. We actually, because we lost our money in the Greenbridge project, we shifted our healthcare plan. We can't afford the Blue Cross Blue Shield Blue Advantage plan anymore. We have a catastrophic plan, and we put our money into growing medicinal herbs, and we take those herbs as medicine, preventative medicine, and we really invest in putting good food and good, you know, healthy natural medicine into our bodies so that we don't have catastrophic kinds of, you know, chronic disease. And now we, you know, if I have a heart attack, then I will have go to the healthcare plan. But my I have a $10,000 deductible. So everything up to that point, I pay out of pocket. And so I've got to be very careful.
This is interesting. Tell us a little bit about Pickard's Mountain. Lyle says that this was inspirational for the people who worked with him. And he's just gotten fairly recently to get up there himself. Are you inviting people to come?
Oh, absolutely. And this is really my wife, Megan, really gets the credit for this project. It's we have three. Our mission is healing the human earth relationship through earth literacy and local economy. That's the stated mission of our endeavor. And what that means is that we're bringing school groups and community groups and individuals together to have a new conversation. And the new conversation is really about local economy. It's about growing our food locally and supporting those that grow food locally. It's about energy. It's about renewable energy in the form of biofuels and solar energy and geothermal energy. And it's about local medicine. It's about how we can take care of ourselves without the use of you know, the big pharma medical regime. We are finding that what's very interesting about this work is the fact that it builds community. We've just finished, Giles Blunden, who you may know, a wonderful green architect here in town, has come out to our land and been excited about what we're doing. And he's retired now, but he took half of our barn, our horse barn, and converted it into a kitchen. A beautiful kitchen with seating made from recycled materials, stuff we had on the farm, things that he could find. We've turned this barn into a place where we can take the food from the garden and make delicious meals and share those meals with other people. During those meals, we have conversations about needing to change the story of our culture. And it's a story that moves us away from globalization and the global economy and big industry and hope that our state government, which God knows is going in the wrong direction, is going to bail us out. And the fact is we need to bail ourselves out. We need to work together. We need to help each other out. We need to ask for help, and we need to offer help when we can. We're very committed to this slow money movement that Carol Hewitt and Lyle—
Tell us about that. I'm not familiar with that.
You know— Having been on the other side of a bank foreclosure, I have a very strong opinion about big banks and banks that are too big to fail and, leaving the guys on Main Street and the little guys that are trying to, you know, build the economy on the side. And so we've decided not to work with banks in any project again.
And even you don't have a checking account. You don't do that. I mean,
well, that's a good point. And there's always the both and, as my mom says. I have a checking account. I do have a checking account, and that's it. And it's not got very much in it, PG, I can tell you these days. But what we do when we need help with a project, I'm building a tea house on this Pickard's Mountain property. And so I went to Lyle and others, and I said, I want to do this project. And what I can do is I can provide you a small return on this, maybe in the form of product. Maybe I can grow herbs and you get herbs, or you get teas, or you get vegetables, or you get something like that. And if you can spot me some cash up front so that I can, you know, put this project up, then let's share in the outcome. You get the early stuff and we'll take the late stuff that comes out of it. Wow. But we need to help each other, and we're not going to rely on the banks. We're not going to borrow money and you know, at interest rates and have them put liens on our property. We're just not going to engage in that kind of relationship. We're going to help each other. When I have a little extra money, hopefully down the road when things, you know, improve, then I can help Lyle out in projects that he's doing. It's a local economy movement that basically uses each other as the bank, and instead of using some outsider that has no knowledge of what we're doing or who we are, and we provide a good return in the form of products and services that we create.
Things that are maybe better dividends than just cash in somebody's account.
Well, you know, in a bank today, you get what, a 0.75, you know, 0.75% return on a CD. So we think that the combination of these wonderful products and services that are local and the community that it builds and the conversation that it has, you know, Lyle can come out, if he helps me with this project, he can come out and have a glass of wine or a beer with me and give me advice on this thing. And he can also say, why aren't you moving faster on this thing? You know, he's got a lot to offer in addition to financial support that I can benefit from.
Well, we've been visiting with Tim Tobin about his essay in Lyle Estelle's book, Small Stories, Big Changes. We're going to take a break, and then Lyle, I hope that you'll introduce us to somebody we know pretty well. That's Blair Pollock. And we'll hear about his essay after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about a new book. It's called Small Stories, Big Changes, Agents of Change on the Front Lines of Sustainability. We're visiting with Lyle Estelle, Tim Tobin, and Blair Pollock, each of whom have contributed to the book. And Lyle, you're the editor. You know, we know Blair pretty well because he whips us and tells us that we've got to get stuff out of our trash and into the recycling bin. That's just the introduction. He's doing a whole lot of other work that saves us money and makes us feel better about things that we'd feel terrible about if I filled up my trash can. Blair, excuse me, Lyle, but I mean, I took my trash out the other day and, went to this big can that the city provided, and I had this little bag. And then the next couple of days, I take out my box. I've got to have two boxes of recyclables, and that's your fault, isn't it?
I'm glad. I only wish you had a roll card for your recycling as well.
I know. Introduce us to Blair's work.
Thanks, DJ. A lot of what we've been talking about is how a community might feed itself and fuel itself and finance itself. And I think that one of the places where Blair comes in is how we might govern ourselves. So working in government and I think that he's an important actor in terms of energy and the environment in this area, and he's got a wonderful chapter in this book.
Thanks, Lyle. And I have to say, apropos of Lyle's earlier remark about it wasn't easy to get everybody on board to write this thing. I've been writing publicly for most of my adult life, and yet it was funny when Lyle came to me and said, so, hey, will you write a chapter in this book? At first, I was like, I don't really have time for that, and what's the terms, and so on and so forth. And then I went home and thought about it, and I said two things to myself. One is that I have never written down my whole story, and that was an opportunity for me. And the other part of it was, you know, it was coming up on 25 years of doing this work, so that's a milestone in a bunch of ways. And it was a good marker to be able to look back and provide some perspective, particularly at a time when the local landfill was closing, and we're really going to have to, you know, for 25, well, really 26 years and 3 months, I've been beating the drum pretty hard for the landfill's going to close, and we're going to have to do something differently. Well, in fact, that finally came true,
I'm sorry to interrupt you on this, but this hits home for me that if you and your colleagues and the community had not bought into this thing, then the landfill absence of the landfill crisis, which is serious, would have been enormous if we were putting all of this stuff out there on the curb.
Would have happened sooner. And in fact, North Carolina collectively, if you thought about the equation of all the trash in the state and how big the hole is that's left, has about 25 years, which, you know, in some people's minds, in an elected official's mind, that's forever. That's, you know, the Nimtoff, not in my term of office, way down the road. And yet in it's the next generation. You know, everybody sitting here with kids and grandkids can look at their kids, or the kids can look back at them and say, you knew and you did nothing. So, you know, we don't want to be the people that they look back at and say, you knew and you did nothing. So, yeah, our landfill in Orange County is a microcosm in every way. It's the smallest publicly owned landfill in the state, one of the smallest operating line landfills anywhere. We just closed out the last 26-acre cell, and you go, you know, to some of the mega landfills, and they're talking about 100-acre cells and 1,000-acre property and so on. So from some people's point of view, there's like, you know, fly over North Carolina. There's plenty of open land. There's plenty of places to dig holes in the ground. But it's a crazy – we're not cats. We don't have a litter box to fill up, and then there's nobody to empty the litter box anyway. So, you know, I've been thinking in this mode for a long time, and what's exciting about the work and having worked in this community in particular, especially, you know, when you travel and compare us with other communities, which I can't help but do, if you think about the recycling arrow, it's like, here's the people that put out their blue box at the curb like UDG. Here's the people that pick it up and remanufacture it into something else. And then there are people that have to actually sell the product into something else. And so without all three pieces of the circle, recycling doesn't happen. So likewise, without all of the people participating, without all of our guys picking it all up and doing a great job, and without all the elected officials getting behind it, providing the money, supporting the projects, we don't have a recycling cycle. So the thing that Lyle, if you look through the table of authors, only I and one of the other 14 authors are at all involved in government. Everybody else is an entrepreneur, a preacher, a nonprofit operator, et cetera. So it's been a really interesting thing to look at the intersection of government and sustainability. And I've been really lucky to work in a community that has, one, embraced this recycling to a huge extent and, you know, made me look successful. Reflected glory is wonderful. It's not like I don't feel like I've done nothing.
We're acknowledging that it wouldn't have happened without you, and also that you had a lot of cooperative people who of like mind. Who helped you overcome the obstacles of people who weren't of like mind.
Right, but you don't – it's notable, in fact, that you don't always get a community that says we are willing to tax ourselves to do this good this important work. And this was even 1987 when the landfill at that point, oddly, was projected to have only 10 years of life left by an engineering calculation. And so that was the impetus for bringing me on board as the recycling guy and starting the programs. Oh, we only have 10 years left. So we kept pushing the closure further into the future. So the fact that all the people in this – 85% of people that live in the towns of Chapel Hill, Carver, and Hillsborough put out that blue box at least once a month. Mm. And that's a phenomenal – you know, it's all voluntary. You get no – fiscal reward for that. Nobody comes around and gives you gift certificates or anything else. People just do it because it was the right thing to do. And that's not a motivator that happens everywhere, but it's the – somebody said the other day in a radio show that community is the magical element behind sustainability. You know, we all talk about it in terms of these material things. It's like people, planet, profits, et cetera. But community is the magic that undergirds sustainability.
Mm-hmm. Well, Blair, you've talked about the past now, but you've hinted that the future also has its challenges. And so what about your work for the next 10 or 15 years and then your successor for the next 10 or 15 years after that?
Well, that's really going to be for Orange County in particular, it'll be a challenge because this is a little bit ironic. The landfill closed and it was a big source of support. Fiscal support and physical support for the recycling programs. Initially, all the recycling was paid for from landfill fees, but now that the landfill's closed, even just the mortgage on our building and the trucks and so forth, part of the salaries, the keeping the lights on, came from landfill fees. That's gone. So when you talk about sustainability, you have to talk about the economic sustainability as a fundamental. And we're going to have to figure out either really dialing back the scope of what we do or a different way to finance it. For the last 8 years, we've financed a lot of recycling with this very unique 3R fee that was unique to our community that we charged to businesses and households to finance the program. We said the landfill can't do it anymore. Let's support it with this. So in this perfect storm of the landfill closing, the local government attorneys and manager determined based on some court cases that these fees were no longer legal. So suddenly that leg of the stool of financing was kicked out from under us. So yes, we're at a real cusp right now. Our community, our three towns and county have worked together really closely compared with a lot of other places in particular around solid waste issues, and that's all going to change radically. So the same way that we all feel like the world is changing radically climatically, the politics of energy is driving things in a whole other direction, whether it's – there was an article in The Atlantic last month saying we will never run out of oil. They talk about fracking and methane hydrate. So along with that, the whole way that we've used solid waste – the idea of the hole in the ground and the idea of there's going to be this endless supply of money from tip fees from garbage, that's all going to change whether we like it or not.
Well, and you scared me to death.
Good. Well, as we all know, most people don't like change that much, and so we're all going to be challenged by this thing. And so the upside is now, for years my message to people and our collective message was save our local landfill space. So except for the people that live right nearby it who are more than happy that it's closed, the rest of us were like, what are we going to do when the landfill closes and ship garbage 100 miles to Sampson County or 100 miles to Montgomery County to throw in a hole down there? That's crazy, right? Mm. Here's this all this wealth. Let's throw it away in a hole down there. And so we're going to change it, as Lyle alluded to earlier. And my friends in Berkeley have a company called Urban Ore, which I think sort of encapsulates the whole message that we're going to have to move towards Urban Ore. So I hope to be part of all of that. I don't know exactly how. Certainly planning to stay with Orange County to see us through this tough transition. And I do have to reiterate, and this isn't gratuitous at all, but without the ongoing support of our elected officials, regardless of the state of the economy and regardless of the politics and who is in office and so on, they've been rock solid across the board in continuing to fund new efforts. In fact, in the face of all this, we just started a new mattress recycling effort because we said people aren't going to take mattresses on the top of their car over to Durham. They're going to throw them out somewhere else. So let's start a mattress recycling program. And there's a mattress recycling company, a guy started in Durham. He's hiring felons. He's putting out high-quality mattresses with recovered material at maybe a third of the cost of a new premium mattress. So, yeah, this whole notion about the local economy extends way past food and farms and biofuels, but into the material economy. So I want to be part of that.
Well, we hope you are, Blair Pollack. And if you join us late, we're talking about a new book, Small Stories, Big Changes. We have its editor, Lyle Estelle, and another one of the authors, Tim Tobin, with us. And the four of us will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Lyle Estelle, Tim Tobin, and Blair Pollack. They're contributors to a new book that Lyle edited called Small Stories, Big Change. And, if you join us late, I've just been inspired by the three stories that these guys have told me. Lyle, what did we miss?
What do you want to know? Blair alluded to one other government person in the book. There are 14 authors here. And really what I was trying to do was get people to tell the personal, the spiritual, the emotional side, the financial side of their roles as agents of change. And so the idea here is Ann Tazewell is the other one that is government related, and Ann's chapter is called Secret Agent to Change Agent. Her father worked for the CIA and helped establish the oil interests in the Middle East back in the 50s. Anne's local, and it's a fascinating chapter, and it looks like that may go on to become full-length book. She's in talks with a publisher now. So the idea is, I think of the 14 authors, some of them are new voices, people that have never published before. Some of them are well-established writers that have been out there and have many books out. And it's that sort of collection, and I'm delighted to have people like Tim and Blair and Anne and Megan contributing to a book like this.
Well, you guys will be reading at various bookstores in the community during for the rest of the year, and the book is available at the local independent bookstores.
Bookstores everywhere, yep.
And
on Amazon, I have to say it.
You have to say it.
For those who can't go out and shop.
You can download it from iTunes.
Great. Well, did we miss anything talking to Tim and Blair?
Gosh, I guess that one of the things I found fascinating is, you know, the anarchist community here kind of took Tim on when he was building Green Bridge. And it almost seems like Tim sort of come around to their way of thinking. In his chapter, he talks a little bit about that. And would you call yourself repentant?
You know, I never understood during the building of Green Bridge the fierce opposition from local youth. I had always considered our intention to be one of looking out for next generations and for, you know, creating something that was an alternative to conventional, traditional building that used lots of fossil fuels. And so when the anarchists began putting posters up and we had some bomb threats on the building and a number of different issues arose, I was really heartbroken, actually. It was very painful for me. I had been a protester in my youth, and I thought, wow, I must be on the other side now and the dark side. It was particularly hard because there's a coal plant two blocks to the south of us, you know, on Greenbridge. And I thought, gosh, why aren't they protesting the coal plant? But here they are, you know, with placards around Greenbridge. And it wasn't until the foreclosure that I was able to really spend some time trying to dig into that issue and trying to understand it. And I read a book by Derek Jensen called Deep Green Resistance. And in that book, I realized what it was that they were saying. And basically, the point of view is that we're in a world of hurt as a society. We are in a world of hurt financially, socially. The disparities are vast. And environmentally, we are, you know, on a very, very dangerous path. So the anarchist point of view is that projects like Green Bridge are a distraction from the great difficulties that we face, and that they are a way for those of us that are progressive liberals to pretend like things are getting better and that we can sort of green our way out of the mess that we're in. And in fact, what they claim is that we need a fundamentally new story and a fundamental shift in the way that we operate. Our entire operating system, if you think of society as a computer system, has a flaw. And the flaw is that as GDP grows, ecosystems decline. So when we hear at the end of NPR every day the ding, ding, ding of the bell on Wall Street, and we celebrate that the market is up and that the economy is thriving, we're also celebrating that some forest somewhere has been destroyed, some indigenous culture has been denied its proper rights, and some, you know, some waterway has been polluted. And so whether you're constructing solar panels or automobiles, you're still part of the industrial complex. And their view is that we need to move towards zero growth or degrowth in order to move towards sustainability. Well, and that's really, I did come around to that point of view.
Well, this is such an important point. And I'd say it's a little bit of a downer after a whole program of of sort of upscale feelings. And Tim Tobin, you catch us right at the end of the program. So with apologies to everybody, you've left us with a very important thought to ponder, but not to solve during this program because we're out of time.
Thanks for
having
me.
I have to thank First Lyle Estelle for the extraordinary book that you put together, for Blair Pollack, and for Tim Tobin for contributing to it, and for all the other authors who contributed to it. This is a great book, and I'm just happy that you shared some of it with us today. And thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.